morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Federal coronavirus relief funding for schools, detection of a fungus that has killed millions of bats, and how local food systems have adapted during the pandemic. It's Friday, June 26th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. Montana reported 37 new cases of COVID-19 yesterday morning, the highest daily number of cases since the pandemic began. The new cases increased the state's total number to more than 800. Despite the resurgence, Governor Steve Bullock announced yesterday that visits to nursing homes and assisted living facilities would be permitted. Meanwhile, applications for unemployment assistance in Montana declined during the week ending June 20th. The U.S. Employment and Training Administration said applications fell to about 2,800, a decrease of nearly 10% from the previous week. The state's unemployment rate was 9% in May. Some university faculty in Montana want the option of requiring students to wear face coverings when the fall semester starts. The governor's MUS Healthy Fall 2020 Task Force released guidelines earlier this month for Montana's universities as they prepare for on-campus academic and student life during the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the guidelines says universities cannot require students to wear cloth face coverings while on campus. But some faculty say that's a problem as the number of COVID-19 cases continues to go up. Joy Honey is president of the Faculty Association and professor of sociology at Montana State University Billings.
There's more and more studies indicating the effectiveness of the use of face coverings, and it seems like a pretty low-tech but high-success action.
University faculty across the state are drafting a letter to the Office of Commissioner of Higher Education and the governor, asking them to allow universities to require face coverings on campus. Honey says 64% of MSUB Faculty Association members who responded to a poll she put together recently said they supported the face covering requirement. The Montana Federation of Public Employees, a union which represents 25,000 public workers in the state, along with other students and faculty associations, are considering whether they will sign on to the letter. Honey says she's not sure how many institutions in the MUS will sign in support, but the faculty union hopes to send the letter sometime next week after getting input and making revisions.
While this letter is coming primarily from faculty and staff groups, it's being discussed with campus leaders as well. So I've spoken with our chancellor about it, and so it's not something that's being done in a vacuum.
Through a spokesperson, Governor Steve Bullock says, quote, "I will be meeting with representatives of the Montana University system soon, and I know they are exploring all sorts of options to keep their students and employees safe," unquote. Ochi could not be reached for comment by deadline for this story. For YPR News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. The U.S. Department of Education is changing its guidance on how federal coronavirus relief funding for public school districts will be shared with private schools. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton explains what this means in Montana.
The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economy Security, or CARES Act, will send roughly $41 million to Montana's public schools. Earlier this year, there was debate about how much of that money federal education officials wanted to pass through public districts to support private schools. That decision is now up to school districts. CARES Act dollars are being delivered through a federal program that normally provides extra funding to public districts based on the total number of low-income students within their district boundaries. Under that formula, public schools are required to provide support to private schools based on their count of eligible low-income students. The Department of Education originally told school districts that formula would change under the CARES Act, requiring public schools to calculate how much they spend on support for private schools on their total student enrollment, increasing federal relief funding for those private schools. The Montana Office of Public Instruction announced Thursday that federal education officials will now allow districts to follow the traditional funding formula or the original guidance under the CARES Act. This change comes as Montana's districts are beginning to receive federal relief funding. State education officials say so far about $1 million has reached districts in the state. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
A recent Montana legislative report says tax revenue from oil and gas production is expected to drop more than 28% this fiscal year, which will impact state and county budgets. Kevin Trevlin reports.
This week's Legislative Fiscal Division report predicts the state will collect almost $39 million in oil and natural gas tax revenue in fiscal year 2020, about 32% less than initially forecast. A division analyst said about half of that money goes into the state's general fund, and the other half is distributed to counties and school districts where the oil and gas was extracted. Senator Tom Richmond, a Republican from Billings, is a member of the Legislative Energy and Telecommunications Committee. He says this is one of the steepest drops in oil and gas revenue he's seen in a decade.
The effect on the general fund, of course, is that it reduces the availability of that revenue, and it has to be made up, backfilled from someplace, or there has to be cuts in spending.
The fiscal division forecast is primarily driven by low oil prices worldwide. It suggests prices drop to a level that makes it unprofitable to pump from open wells in Montana. Legislative analysts say less travel under lockdown conditions is likely impacting the cost of oil. Richmond says global oversupply has also impacted prices over the last 3 years. Counties and school districts that receive oil and gas taxes are expected to see $34 million less than expected through fiscal year 2021. The fiscal division report says hotels, restaurants, and bars will also be impacted from the drop in oil and gas production.
And I drive by our hotels, and they've had some pretty empty parking lots.
Republican State Representative Joel Crowder serves Richland County in eastern Montana. It received the most oil and gas tax revenue of any county during the last quarter reported, $5.4 million. Crowder says a slowdown will hurt all of his constituents, tied to extractive industries or not.
It's really just agriculture and oil and gas energy, you know, development that is big for our economy. And agriculture is struggling right now as well. So yeah, it is a tough time across the board.
Crowder says Richland County has previously froze hiring, essentially in response to oil and gas price fluctuations over the last 3 years. Kevin Trevelin, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
A Montana electric cooperative and a large solar panel developer recently struck an agreement to establish two 550-acre solar installments in one southeast Montana county. Kayla DeRoche reports.
Energy company Clenera will develop the solar project for electric cooperative Basin Electric. Clenera is headquartered out of Boise, Idaho, and has built solar operations across the United States, mainly concentrated in the Southwest. Basin Electric says construction will bring 300 temporary jobs and two or three permanent positions to the county. Almost 3,000 people currently live in Fallon County, and County Commissioner Steve Baldwin says every new person or job opportunity counts.
So we're happy to have that.
Fallon County granted the development a property tax abatement over the first 10 years. Basin Electric forecasts the solar project will contribute around $8 million in property taxes to the county and $5 million to the state over its expected 35-year life. Baldwin says that's small compared to the tax base the oil and gas industry provides, but he's excited about the state's added renewable energy resource.
We've got a ways to go, but you definitely have to start somewhere.
Federal data shows that solar power makes up less than 1% of Montana's energy generation. Jeff Fox with Renewable Northwest, a group that advocates for wind and solar power generators, says utility-scale solar farms currently contribute about 20 megawatts overall to Montana's electric grid. The Cabin Creek Solar Project will add an extra 150 megawatts.
So it's the largest solar project in Montana by far.
Cabin Creek Solar is expected to come online in late 2023. Clenera says that it's also involved in a potential solar farm in Dillon, along with others in their early stages of development. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
The Blackfeet Nation released draft legislation yesterday that would permanently protect the Badger 2 Medicine bordering Glacier National Park from industrial resource development. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports Montana's congressional delegation says they are reviewing the draft language of the proposed bill.
The release of the draft legislation follows a big win for the Blackfeet tribe earlier this month when a ruling from the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. effectively canceled the last remaining oil and gas lease in the area, which is the sacred homeland of the Blackfeet people. The bill would designate 130,000 acres of the Badger II Medicine within the Lewis and Clark National Forest as a cultural heritage area. The move would prevent future industrial development on the land. Congress has withdrawn the land from oil and gas leasing, and it was designated as a traditional cultural district under federal law. Blackfeet Historic Preservation Officer John Murray says those current protections don't provide certainty that the area won't be developed in the future. He says the tribe previously wanted the Badger II Medicine to be designated as a national monument in order to get that kind of permanent protection.
We think that now that the monument doesn't offer that permanent protection because, we've seen like Bears Ears and Grand Staircase monument get modified by a different administration. So
the cultural heritage area designation would allow non-commercial timber harvest to continue and would guarantee continued public access for hunting, fishing, and hiking. Conservation groups have long supported protecting the landscape, which serves as important habitat for grizzly bears and other wildlife moving between Glacier National Park and the Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex. Communication staff for each member of Montana's congressional delegation say Democrat John Tester and Republican Steve Daines and Greg Gianforte are willing to work with the tribe and are reviewing the proposal. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
A fungus that has killed millions of bats in the eastern and central parts of the U.S. is now spreading across the West. Biologists recently detected it for the first time in Montana. Rachel Kramer reports local scientists are collecting data inside caves, below bridges, and under the night sky.
Keep two hands on and you should be good.
At the Azure Cave in north central Montana, climbing expert Zach Ingstead helps several people rope up. One of them is Lori Hanoska Brown, the non-game wildlife management bureau chief for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks.
Okay, so we're just getting started. We're about to go over the first cliff. So how long is this first descent, Zach?
70 feet.
70 feet. And so far we've got 5 bats that are quietly hanging on the walls.
The goal today is to swab live bats and collect samples of feces, or guano.
So you don't rub it like this. You want to roll it across the wing and across the nose, like several times both.
Okay.
Q-tip.
That audio of sample collection in the Azure Cave is from wildlife photographer Ronan Donovan, who joined the researchers on their trip. Their work is part of a large-scale effort to track something that's causing massive numbers of bats to die in North America, something that just showed up in Montana. FWP announced last week that samples of bat guano under bridges in Daniels, Richland, and Fallon counties tested positive for a fungus called Pseudogymnoascus destructens, which scientists often refer to as PD.
It's like a mold that's growing on their bodies.
Hanoska Brown says the white fungus can spread between bats when they squeeze through the same small cracks in caves or roost in tight clusters during their winter hibernations.
We believe that it's so irritating that they wake up. Sometimes it appears to be dehydrating them. There's all sorts of different things going on physiologically.
She says this can disrupt their metabolisms and deplete the fat reserves they need to make it through winter. White nose syndrome, the disease caused by the PD fungus, was first discovered in New York State in 2006. Since then, it spread to several dozen states and Canadian provinces, wiping out 6.7 million bats in North America. Kimberly Dickerson with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is the White Nose Syndrome Coordinator for 8 states stretching from Montana to Kansas.
It was found in Nebraska and Kansas early on, and 2 years ago, then it was found in South Dakota and in Wyoming.
In May, the North Dakota Game and Fish Department reported White Nose Syndrome killed a cluster of little brown bats not far from Montana's border. FWP announced the fungus had been detected in Montana on June 15th. Lori Hanoska Brown with FWP says the PD fungus is not known to affect humans, pets, livestock, or other wildlife, but people should be concerned about large-scale die-offs of bats. Bats act like natural pesticides, eating the insects that damage crops and trees.
If you just don't like mosquitoes, you've got to thank the bats, because without the bats around, we would likely have more mosquitoes, which can lead to more disease transmission et cetera, et cetera. So their role in that cycle of just ecosystem health is really important.
To understand where and how the fungus is spreading, Hanaska Brown says getting good data is key. In addition to collecting samples from bats, they're partnering with the Montana Natural Heritage Program to find out where bats live in the state via acoustic monitoring. During June and July, crews set up devices across Montana that record the echolocation calls bats make when they're active at night. The Heritage Program senior zoologist Dan Bakken says this will boost the state's baseline data, allowing scientists to recognize sudden declines in a bat population and long-term trends.
We need ways to continue to monitor to see if diseases like white nose syndrome actually are having the same impacts that they do in other areas of the country. And if any treatment is developed, you know, if we can deploy that effectively.
Currently, no cure exists for white nose syndrome, but scientists are working on several experimental treatments, including a vaccine. Bakken says the extent to which the fungus will affect the 15 species of bats in Montana is also uncertain. Scientists know some species, like the little brown bat, which lives throughout much of North America, are very susceptible. But there isn't a lot of evidence showing what the PD fungus means for other bat species that only live in the West. Secondly, just a small percentage of bats in Montana use caves compared to their counterparts in the East. Emily Almberg, a disease ecologist with FWP, says this could help slow the spread of the fungus.
The conditions of caves, in terms of humidity and temperature, are what drive, in large part, the maintenance of the fungus.
She says a lot of bats in Montana use rock talus slopes and tree roosts, and they're more spread out compared to some of the bat populations on the East Coast.
There is this other open question about how it'll play out in the West. You know, we're hopeful that it'll look different. I don't know that it will, but we're hopeful.
North American bats do not carry the type of coronavirus that causes COVID-19, but there is concern that humans could accidentally transfer it to the bats. FWP has temporarily prohibited the live handling of these animals. Anyone who sees a sick or recently deceased bat or group of bats should contact health officials or state biologists who can provide further guidance. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
The coronavirus pandemic has hit Montana's cattle ranchers hard. Midwest meat plants shuttered because of disease outbreaks, upending the traditional supply chain and leaving ranchers with animals they might not be able to sell. Yellowstone Public Radio's Sarah Brown reports on the role burgeoning local food systems might play going forward. This story is part of a series on lasting ways Montana is adapting to the pandemic. It's funded in part by the Solutions Journalism Network.
Hey, how's it going? What's the name?
Michelle Szczesinski is general manager of the Yellowstone Valley Food Hub, a cooperative that started a couple of years ago to connect Billings area farmers and ranchers with buyers. During the statewide shutdown that took effect at the end of March, business spiked big time.
So we've really seen like a tenfold increase in our sales.
That has been a definite boon for more than a dozen area producers who sell their meat and produce direct to consumers. It's allowed the group to hire a new GM, Szczesinski, and to ponder how the pandemic might change how people restock refrigerators.
We don't have every type of product available all the time, so I think there is a level of convenience that you're sacrificing. You know, we have pickups and deliveries one day a week on Thursdays, and you have to order by Tuesday night. So there's a level of planning ahead.
So that's the rub. And here's another, price. Products at the co-op, including beef, are more expensive than what you'd find at the supermarket. Szczesinski says there's virtue in that. Those dollars stay in the local economy and allow consumers to connect to farmers and ranchers, as well as to the land that produces their food.
And I think that's how you can really build resiliency in a food system. As coronavirus has kind of taught us, we're seeing a lot of fragility be demonstrated in these larger food systems.
There's a growing consumer base who would prefer local product.
That's Montana State University agricultural economist Eric Belasco.
You know, they tend to be higher income earners, people who are traveling. Well, they want to spend a little bit more on their product if it's, you know, locally grown. I think that's fine. But, you know, that's not the typical American consumer. I think the typical American consumer wants a low price, high quality beef product.
It's not that economists like Belasco don't understand how coronavirus has upended the system. It's that the system generally works. Feeder calves raised in Montana and finished at a handful of colossal Midwest feedlots then go to nearby meatpacking plants. Only about 5% of Montana cattle are processed here. This vast assembly line system means Montana beef can get to supermarkets everywhere at a cheaper price. During the pandemic, the system gummed up. The four major meatpacking plants responsible for 80% of U.S. cattle slaughter intermittently suspended operations because of COVID-19 outbreaks in the workforce. With processing down, demand for Montana's feeder calves plummeted. Prices tanked by more than 30%. At the same time, demand for meat by homebound Americans increased, leading some consumers to pay more for a fewer number of cuts.
It's kind of the most frustrating of situations.
Ben Thomas directs Montana's Department of Agriculture.
The same people who aren't fairly being compensated for the beef they're producing are then going to the grocery store and being asked to pay more.
But Thomas says the current disruption to national supply chains doesn't so much reveal the intrinsic flaws in that system. The pandemic is a singular event, so much as highlight the intrinsic value of a local system. In other words, post-pandemic, there's a role for both.
Look, we're always going to be a state that produces high-quality commodities that are eventually exported around the world. That's something we've done as long as the state has existed. It's something that has been a huge economic benefit, and we'll keep doing that. But also on top of that, we're now, as an industry, more diverse than we've ever been before. That's good for producers, but it's also a huge opportunity for consumers. We can do it all.
The state's using federal CARES Act funds to bankroll new programs that support local food systems. The Ag Department's offering $500,000 in grants. The Governor's Office of Economic Development is putting $5 million into another grant program to help companies scale up. This would include Montana's few dozen independent meat processors that have struggled for decades to compete with the Midwest behemoths. It would also get more Montana beef onto Montana tables and shore up a growing regional food system for an uncertain future. Here's Thomas again from the Department of Ag.
I think the effects will be lasting long beyond COVID. There's nothing more fundamental to human civilization than paying a farmer directly for food that you're going to eat and feed your family.
Back at the food hub, Michelle Szczesinski is helping customers do just that.
That's it?
Thanks.
Great, thank you. Have a good day.
She fills orders placed online, loading them straight from rows of coolers into cars.
Consumers are now seeing the value in supporting local food and local communities, but then they're also tasting it, and it's good food.
Sarah Brown, YPR News.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds Monday morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.